Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, August 31st, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Trump Justice Department sues Washington, saying their universities don't have the right to grant in-state tuition to immigrant students. Family medicine doctor practicing in McCall for 23 years speaks about the exodus of OBGYN doctors from Idaho due to the state's law criminalizing protecting the health of the mother. And environmentalists appeal over Endangered Species Act violations in approving stibnite, gold, and antimony mine in the National Forest east of McCall. It's a mine project from Perpetua. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Trump Justice Department sued Washington and three other states, claiming they don't have the right to grant in-state tuition to students who are in the country without what the federal government defines as legal status. Washington has been helping students who lack legal immigration status get in-state tuition at universities and colleges since 2003. They grant in-state tuition to those students if they meet residency and diploma requirements. The American Immigration Council in 2024 found 3% of the students at Washington's universities and colleges are eligible for in-state tuition under the program, or 15,216 students total. The Trump Justice Department claims Washington's policies amount to blatant unequal treatment favoring students who have lived in Washington over U.S. citizens from other states that are not eligible for in-state tuition. Trump Assistant Attorney General Brett A. Shumate wrote in a news release, "This Department of Justice will not tolerate American students being treated like second-class citizens in their own country. The differences in tuition rates are substantial, which can result in many Washington residents not availing themselves of their right to an education. For example, in-state tuition at the University of Washington's Seattle campus is $13,400 compared to $44,460 for out-of-state students. At Evergreen State College in Olympia, in-state tuition is $8,643 compared to $32,800 for non-residents." Washington Attorney General's Office spokesperson Mike Falk said the Trump Justice Department lawsuit is politically motivated. Falk said the administration is challenging longstanding Washington laws that recognize the potential and promise of all our residents, regardless of citizenship status. The other states the Justice Department sued over the same issue Thursday were Oregon, New Mexico, and Arizona. The Trump administration had previously challenged the in-state tuition rules in 17 other states. The Montgomery, Alabama-based Southern Poverty Law Center sees the lawsuit as part of Trump's racist ethnic cleansing agenda. The law center wrote on its website, "These lawsuits fall neatly into the anti-immigrant movement's wider agenda to make every federal agency and immigration enforcement entity marginalize immigrants and further illustrate the administration's deep ideological ties to anti-immigrant extremism." The lawsuit is also part of the Trump administration's war on diversity and could take away Americans' rights to attend schools that are sufficiently diverse and therefore an opportunity to learn about the world without having to travel. There also is a proposal in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 to take away student loan access to all students who attend schools with immigrant-inclusive tuition policies. The nonpartisan think tank, the Niskanen Center says up to 67% of all Americans enrolled in U.S. higher education could lose access to federal student aid because their state or university offers in-state tuition to undocumented or DACA students. The center says about 10.7 million students are enrolled in higher education institutions in states that allow undocumented residents access to in-state tuition. Racist hate groups have been calling on the Trump Supreme Court to reverse the 1982 Plyler versus Doe decision on public schools, which found states cannot prevent undocumented immigrant children from attending public school unless a substantial state interest is involved. That decision does not apply to colleges and universities, but it does show a state interest in supporting education for all residents, regardless of immigration status. Many of the recipients of in-state tuition include Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA recipients. The Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and 41 partner organizations wrote to Congress in March saying, "Overturned or undermined, it could result in hundreds of thousands of children, none of whom can be blamed for their lack of immigration status, being shut out of education at the most important time for children to be in school."
This has been Oregon's largest wildfire year on record, and for the state's small tourism-dependent communities, wildfires bring economic and emotional consequences long before any flames reach their doorstep. Many towns have been under evacuation warnings for weeks this summer, emptying them of tourists and leaving locals without income. In Government Camp, a village on the slopes of Mount Hood, Julia Williams runs Upward Spiral Collective, a mental health and suicide prevention nonprofit. She says mountain communities like her have higher than average rates of depression and suicide, challenges that can get worse when fires rage nearby.
When the tourists aren't coming up, we start having to whittle down. Say at the resorts, they have multiple restaurants and multiple bars. They'll have to close some of them and funnel people towards the other ones. That leaves an entire town without work.
Williams adds, since employers' needs get more sporadic during wildfire season, it's hard for people to receive steady unemployment benefits to keep paying their bills. She says financial help from the state to get people through smoke season would go a long way. Sierra Koss is with Extreme Weather Survivors, a nonprofit she started after witnessing the 2020 Labor Day fires in Oregon. Koss says her organization has interviewed survivors of floods, storms, and fires across the country to better understand how to support them.
I think most Americans really, really want investments and want their tax dollars used to help keep them and their families safe, especially in an environment where there's more and more communities on fire.
Koss criticizes the Trump administration for systematically dismantling agencies, cutting jobs, and slashing budgets that help communities survive disasters. She adds, in order to make the best disaster policies, survivors need a seat at the table.
Survivors trust each other. If you've lived through this, you are best equipped to guide future policy work to prevent future disasters or to recover.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tie-dye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Hungadunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hungadunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
Democratic Washington Lieutenant Governor Danny Heck says Trump's trade war with Canada has materially damaged relationships between the U.S. and its neighbor to the north, and he believes Canada will further seek economic independence from the U.S. in international trade. Heck told the Spokesman Review, "Both sides are going to suffer. The president seems to be proceeding on the assumption that they need us way more than we need them." Republican U.S. Representative Michael Baumgartner of Eastern Washington's 5th Congressional District says he is optimistic the U.S. and Canada will eventually find a suitable trade deal. Baumgartner said, "I think in the long term, the U.S.-Canadian trade relationship will be strong." Earlier this month, Trump unilaterally imposed 50% tariffs on $20 billion of Canadian imports, a move which is likely to harm U.S. consumers by increasing prices for imported goods. Canada is the second largest international trading partner with Washington after China. Last year, sellers sold $7 billion worth of Canadian goods in Washington. Idaho Rivers United and other environmental groups filed an appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court seeking to stop work on the Stibnite gold mine and antimony mine reopening on Forest Service land east of McCall in Valley County. The groups filed the appeal Tuesday of last week. The groups are appealing the failure of the federal district court to issue a stop work order, even though the court last year agreed with plaintiffs that the Fish and Wildlife Service's incidental take statements were inadequate for wolverine and bull trout, which are protected under the Endangered Species Act. Perpetua Resources, the Boise-based subsidiary of a Canadian mining corporation, is working to reactivate open-air mining pits in the century-old Stibnite mining district in order to extract gold and antimony from the ore there. According to the Lewiston Tribune, Perpetua says it will backfill one of the pits, called the Yellow Pine Pit, to reestablish flow for the East Fork South Salmon River to support fish migration. Conservation groups in the Nez Perce tribe have opposed the project, saying it will harm air quality, water quality, and public health in general. The conservation group sued, saying the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is violating the Endangered Species Act because it is failing to protect bull trout, wolverine, and white bark pine. The Nez Perce tribe has filed a separate lawsuit citing similar concerns plus violations of treaty rights. Idaho Rivers United mining and policy manager Sidney Lavasse wrote in a press release, "We believe this appeal is essential to prevent long-term damage to this cherished part of Idaho. The stakes for local water quality, wildlife, and surrounding public lands are simply too high to ignore." Mountaintop Law founder Julia Thrower noted the U.S. Forest Service last year found the no-action alternative, in which the mine reopening would not move forward, was the, quote, environmentally preferable alternative. U.S. Forest Service documents said the mining would result in, quote, surface disturbance and associated impacts. Thrower said the Forest Service chose doing nothing as the environmentally preferred alternative. I think that's a pretty strong statement coming from the agency that has reviewed every aspect of this project. Perpetua has included environmental restoration of the old mining district as part of the project. The company says it will remove legacy materials, restore stream channels, and enhance riparian plantings if the project moves forward, things the Forest Service considered when making its recommendation. The Forest Service did not follow its own recommendation, and the final record of decision by the agency allowed work on the mine to continue. The work will continue unless there is an injunction from a higher court. At a forum during the Alturas Institute's Exceptional Women Conference in Sun Valley, family medicine doctor Caitlin Gunderson of McCall spoke about the exodus of OBGYN doctors from Idaho, which began with the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision and the implementation of Idaho's trigger law criminalizing doctors who perform abortion care to save the health of the mother.
Idaho is not alone, as many of you know, or you may be from other states that have very restrictive laws, but Idaho has one of the strictest. So essentially the way the trigger bans were written, right, well before the fall of Roe and Dobbs in 2020, 2021. Idaho has a not so fun, unique situation is that we have overlapping trigger bans, which further confound. We've got a civil penalty associated with providing what is considered an illegal abortion, and then the criminal ban requires a minimum of 2 years in prison for a physician who is found to provide an unlawful, quote-unquote, unlawful abortion with only essentially a death exception. The death of the pregnant person is the only way you could have a lawful abortion, or in the case of rape or incest in the first trimester. There's all kinds of, and we'll talk a little bit about just how problematic that is, both of those so-called exceptions, and why they lead physicians to feel that they have no room, not only to take care of, you know, patients who are in medically complex situations, that termination of pregnancy is the only manner in which their health can be preserved, but there's also, and I hope we have a chance to talk about this, the trickle down to miscarriage management, miscarriage being one of the most common pregnancy complications that is experienced. Somewhere in, you know, 25% of women somewhere in their reproductive lifetime will have at least one miscarriage. Some women, tragically, more than that. And this ban has very deeply affected the care that folks can receive, even in the setting of very wanted pregnancies.
That was Dr. Caitlin Gunderson, who has practiced family medicine in the McCall area for 23 years. Her talk at the Exceptional Women Conference comes as Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador is appealing a federal judge's decision in Boise this month to allow abortions in Idaho if the health of the woman is at risk, because Idaho's criminal abortion law completely bans abortions at any stage of pregnancy, with only very narrow exceptions, including if the life of the mother is at risk. Gunderson was asked to describe how she was trained to help patients with pregnancy complications before the Dobbs decision. Gunderson replied, "Pregnancy complications are as unique as the people who have them.
There's no two situations that are the same, but the training you receive is to provide, in some cases, emergent care. You know, there are very, where there is no option, there's no waiting if, you know, say a situation I've been in 15 weeks, a woman is mid-miscarriage, but she is still pregnant, she's hemorrhaging in front of you, right? You have to make very quick decisions about what you're going to do. If a woman is sitting in front of you and she's 18, 19 weeks pregnant and she comes in with a blood pressure of 220 and her kidneys are failing and her lungs are filling up with fluid, which these are no exaggeration, these are real situations that I've encountered, that all of us have encountered. You know, my first move as a rural family doc when this walks into my unit is to call in consultation with a maternal fetal medicine specialist, right, and make a decision about how imminently we need to move towards treatment of that condition. But in those types of emergent situations, the treatment offered, no one's forcing anyone to take a road, right? But the standard of care would be to offer termination of pregnancy, such that in the latter example I was describing, preeclampsia at a very early gestation, which tends to be one of the most severe forms of preeclampsia and the most dangerous, right? We are talking somebody who may be presenting at that point in the midst of organ failure, moving towards sometimes irreversible damage to those systems that preeclampsia affects, which are many. I only named some of the potential complications there.
Dr. Gunderson spoke about other areas where lawmakers who do not practice medicine are moving to take away the right to proper health care.
We're absolutely seeing it in Idaho that, you know, reproductive health, the abortion issue per se, is an easy target because we know that it has a long history, right? And it can be a very challenging topic. Folks will often hear me say, you know, one of the silver linings of if one can be found in the tragedies that have occurred, is that we're actually talking about these issues in Idaho since Dobbs. You know, having practiced 2 decades in Idaho, you know, prior to Dobbs, I know that, you know, it was up, you know, folks didn't really understand the intersection of abortion care, being able to see an OBGYN for basic gynecologic care. Like, how could those two things be related, you know? They're deeply related. The miscarriage care that I talked about, but yeah, this is, you know, the most upfront and egregious upfront of, you know, what we broadly refer to as the criminalization of the standard of medicine. And, you know, shameless plugs all day long for the Idaho Coalition for Safe Healthcare. We were created out of this need that. Certainly, Dobbs and the abortion bans and the loss of OBGYNs and the stark reality of how many people could find it possible to continue practicing in our state. But we're working on a broad range of issues because, yes, it's happening all over the place. If you're paying attention at the legislature last year, you know, you see it pop up. We're going to ban, you know, mRNA vaccines, right? We're going to, we worked on lots of legislation last year that takes things even further, that makes mifepristone, which is a drug, yes, associated with abortion, but it's actually half of the medical regimen associated with safe medical management of a miscarriage. That way, there was an attempt last year in the legislature to make that a Schedule IV drug. What that means is it takes it out of the hands of people who need it. Oftentimes, medical management of miscarriage still legal in the state of Idaho, but if you can't access the medication, if you show up at a hospital who can't stock it because of the rules and regulations around that the DEA puts forward with Schedule IV medications. So all of these trickle-down things that are further attacks on, again, standard medical care.
That was family medicine doctor Caitlin Gunderson of McCall speaking at the Alturas Institute's Exceptional Women's Conference in Sun Valley on Thursday. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story.
This is Hell, and I'm the Bitter Blind Broke Gaptooth radio show host Chuck Mertz, who tells you that right here on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 90.3 FM, and KRFP.org at 11 a.m. each and every Sunday morning. This is Hell has been manufacturing dissent since 1996, bringing listeners like you the news that scares the news as an alternative to alternative radio, independent from independent media, and KRFP is one of only a few outlets around the world that supports our work. In today's political climate, that support is more important than ever to fight against the damage done by corporate-controlled right-wing media that has taken over the public's airwaves. In the past year, This Is Hell has talked about issues you will not hear on corporate or even public radio, like neoliberalism, feminism, sexism, racism, conservatism, cannibalism, and the meaning of infinity. If that's the kind of programming you want to hear, see you on Sunday morning.
The Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission is now drafting guidelines that would prevent large power users, such as giant artificial intelligence data centers, from passing off infrastructure costs to regular power customers. The Washington legislature failed to pass regulations on data center power use during this year's session, but the Public Utilities and Transportation Commission's rules could impact a future bill that lawmakers are likely to introduce next year. The commission is proposing requiring data centers to cut their electricity consumption during times the grid is facing strain due to power shortages, and requiring data centers pay more money up front. They're also recommending requiring them to enter into longer contracts or considering requiring them to pay surcharges for harder-to-measure costs. Currently, Seattle, Spokane, Renton, Burien, Federal Way, Marysville, Snohomish, and Skagit have temporary moratoriums on new large data centers. Reuters Ipsos did a poll in June which found 77% of Americans nationwide are concerned artificial intelligence will make power more expensive. Regulators say even though Microsoft and Amazon agree they should pay for infrastructure built specifically to serve them, regulators who spoke at the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission August 12th meeting said data centers can drive up prices in ways that are hard to quantify. They noted Amazon outbid Puget Sound Energy for a massive 1.2 gigawatt solar farm and battery storage facility in Oregon. This comes at a time when Washington utilities are under pressure from the state to increase investments in clean energy. Puget Sound Energy board member Malcolm McCulloch told the commission, "We saw the direct effects of competition in the market for renewable generation." Puget Sound Energy proposes requiring large load users such as data centers to help fund geothermal or small modular nuclear reactors, the latter of which Puget Sound Energy classifies as a clean energy technology.
As more cities and counties in Washington state hit pause on new data center development, a recent poll shows public opposition is growing nationwide. A new survey from Heatmap News finds that 75% of Americans are against having a data center built in their community. Don Marsh, chair for the Washington Clean Energy Coalition, is sympathetic. He says he supports responsible AI use, but says there are a lot of external costs like carbon emissions and water use that are not being taken into consideration.
And also, the AI companies are by and large not making money. So the question is, how does this all evolve to a economy that works for both people who need to use AI, but also for everybody else?
So far, Seattle and at least 10 other local jurisdictions have placed temporary bans on new data center construction, citing concerns about rising electricity costs and high water use in drought-stricken areas. Proponents of the facilities, including local electrician unions, praise the high-paying jobs they can create. Marsh says Washington State lacks clear policy on the centers, mirroring a national trend where restrictions arise mainly from local pushback. He adds Governor Ferguson's working group formed last year leaned heavily toward industry, including Microsoft and Amazon.
We wanted to see a real balance that took into account the impact on local communities, their energy prices, water availability, and the quality of their air and noise.
Many new data centers are relying on gas power, which Marsh says contradicts the state's